This is a podcast from the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge.
My name is Gavin Dawson and I work at the Victorian Studies Centre at the University of Leicester. My particular area of research over the last few years has been on Darwin, but particularly his work on sex and sexual selection. I became very interested in the reception of his book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, which was published in 1871. And the first question that sprung to my mind, certainly, was how a book that is so suffused with an interest in sex and sex's relation to evolution would be received in a culture like that of Victorian Britain that was famously uncomfortable with talking about sexuality and the desires of men and women. Darwin starts off with natural selection, which I think most people understand. But the problem that he always had with natural selection was how to explain certain features of animals that seem to actively work against their survival in terms of natural selection. So things like the huge decorated tail feathers of peacocks. Sexual selection essentially argues that things that we would see as being kind of aesthetically beautiful but essentially kind of non-utilitarian in the view of natural selection are produced through a separate mechanism. And this mechanism is that certain features are attractive to members of the opposite sex. Here the selectors are not actually the impersonal agency of nature, but rather individual creatures. And for Darwin, in the animal world, this was specifically females. This is the reason why it's male peacocks who have the amazing tail feathers, whereas peahens are rather drab. Peahens are the ones who choose, peacocks are the ones who display themselves. I think that the central problem, and it's not just for me, but for many people who read The Descent of Man closely, is that the evidence that Darwin presents for why there is this change from in animals, where it is exclusively the females who are the selectors in sexual selection, to in humans, it being the males, is actually so kind of lacking. It's kind of not very convincing at all. And this is unusual for Darwin, who's famously kind of very convincing in the way that he uses evidence from a whole range of different areas. He seems to suggest that it's because in humans that men have grown so much physically and intellectually stronger than women that they've been able to usurp the power of selection. And he presents women as essentially being interested in being passively decorous, the way that they kind of wear jewellery, the way that they dress their hair, often using tail feathers. So you get an interesting connection between sexual selection in the animal world, particularly with birds, and then sexual selection in the human world. I mean, I think that one of the clear problems that Darwin has is that to see human females as selectors would be to suggest that they actually become aroused, that they become excited by displays of male beauty, by displays of male fighting, by the sounds of male singing, by, and this is something that he discusses in The Descent of Man, the smells of male bodies. This is something that for Darwin personally, but for Victorian culture much more broadly, is extremely problematic. Victorian culture generally portrays women as being kind of maternal and asexual and repositories of moral virtue, as opposed to men, which Victorian culture can condone as having kind of sexual desires. Women, that can never be acceptable in Victorian culture. And so in many ways, one can see Darwin's rather convoluted, rather muddled depiction of sexual selection as kind of fitting in extraordinarily conveniently to prevailing Victorian cultural mores about the position of men and women, and in particular their sexual desires. I'm now looking at examples of artworks that in sometimes oblique but other times obvious and explicit ways engage with some of the key themes that Darwin introduced into 19th century culture, but also that engage particularly with the problematic of sexual selection. One of the important things about the popular reception of Darwin and The Origin of Species in particular in 1859 is that it coincided, it didn't start off or kind of instigate this, but it literally coincided with a growing interest in the apes that were seen even long before Darwin as being closest to humans, and in particular to gorillas. It's actually in the same decade, the 1850s, as Darwin's Origin, that the first gorilla specimens reach Great Britain and also France. It's in fact Paris and the Natural History Museum there that first receives gorilla specimens in 1852. In 1860, so the year after the Origin of Species, an infamous French-American explorer who was called Paul Duchelu comes to England from New York with a potboiler of a book called Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa, which describe his journeys into the interior of Central Africa and give rather kind of lurid accounts of his hunting of gorillas. To publicise this book, which was published by John Murray, who was also the publisher of The Origin of Species and later The Descent of Man, Duchelu displayed large collections of pickled gorillas at the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Institution, and these remains were then put on display at the British Museum as well. This, it's well known, induced a real kind of frenzy, a real mania for knowledge about apes and about gorillas, and the famous satirical magazine Punch carried numerous, and they're often actually, they genuinely are funny cartoons of gorillas acting like human beings, so going to dinner parties, pleading their rights, wearing sandwich boards, things like that. And this coincidence of the gorilla parts coming to Europe and Duchelu suddenly kind of creating this popular interest coincides with the response to The Origin of Species in the late 1850s and early 1860s. And so inevitably the two become connected. And so a lot of discussion of the origin is filtered through the idea of humans and gorillas as being kin, as being close relations, cousins, as they're often called in Punch. This despite the fact that in The Origin of Species, Darwin only on one occasion mentions in a very oblique way humans and doesn't actually mention the large man-like apes at all. So even though there is that kind of absence from The Origin of Species, it's amazing how those become the icons of the popular reception of Darwinism. The two artworks that I'm going to be looking at actually come from much later in the century, the late 1870s and the early 1880s, but actually I think they connect very importantly with a lot of these earlier representations of apes. The first piece that I'm looking at is a bronze sculpture by the French artist Emmanuel Frémiet. It's called Gorilla Carrying Off a Woman, and it's from 1887. But I think what is most interesting about this piece is that actually it's a later version of an original that Frémiet had originally executed in the late 1850s. This was a plaster work, and it was actually refused entry to the Paris Salon by the jury in 1859. This is actually a few months then before the publication of The Origin of Species. It was actually displayed at the Salon behind a curtain, and Frémiet was given permission to do this by the superintendent of the Salon. In the exhibition, we clearly have the 1887 version, and this is because the original, the 1859 version, was actually destroyed. It was smashed to pieces by vandals in 1861, and there is only one particularly clear photograph of it. That's the only way that we know of it. The piece in the exhibition shows the gorilla, I think, in a very defensive position. Under one arm it has a woman who is resisting to some extent. She's a naked woman. Interestingly, certainly by the style of her hair, her racial characteristics seem to be Caucasian. So this isn't necessarily an image of an indigenous African woman being abducted from an African village. Frémiet was responsible for a number of sculptural works that represent confrontations between animals and humans. He had a very good technical knowledge of comparative anatomy and always insisted on the factual veracity of his animal representations. I think one thing that's interesting here is that in many ways this is a piece, both in the 1859 version and the 1887 one, that is in no way agreeing with Darwin's theories about the relation between humans and animals. Here the gorilla is noticeable for its brutality and savagery, and it's forcefully taking this woman away, apparently against her will. There is no sense of kinship or affinity between the two species here. In fact, it's their differences that are being emphasised. The 1887 version had a very different public response to the 1859 one, in that it was shown at the Paris Salon, where it became very celebrated, and in fact won that year's Salon Medal of Honour. So there seems to be a kind of a change that has happened in public attitudes between the 1850s and the 1880s. Certainly, although it's in some way a controversial piece, it's much less problematic, much less scandalous, as witnessed by the fact that it still survives. In this piece, I think one of the things that is interesting here is that the representation is very much of the gorilla as an abhuman other. So once again, going against kind of Darwinian ideas. But an abhuman other who takes a female very much against her will. It's a very kind of fearful image. It's an image of natural savagery confronting an idealized and kind of clearly aesthetically appealing woman. This isn't necessarily, though, the only way in which it was interpreted. And I want to point to one review of the piece from 1859 that I think, although it's predating Darwin's Origin of Species and certainly The Descent of Man in 1871, I think it raises certain issues that would then later be taken up by people who are responding to Darwin's theory of sexual selection. And that's the suggestion made by the famous poet and art reviewer Charles Baudelaire. He writes, "Why not a crocodile, a tiger, or any other animal which is liable to eat a woman? But that is not the point. Be assured that this is no question of eating, but of worse. Now it is the ape alone, the gigantic ape, at once more and less than a man, that has been known to betray a human appetite for woman. He is carrying her off. Will she be able to resist? This is the question which will engage the entire female public. A strange and complex feeling composed partly of terror and partly of preapic curiosity will sweep it to success." Certainly the statue partakes in and invokes a classical and medieval trope of apes as representations of male lasciviousness. And interestingly, this is something that comes across even in 19th century works of natural history. Du Chaillu's Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa, for instance, is replete with accounts of gorillas carrying off African natives and in various kind of unspecified ways having their wicked way with them. And this also comes across even in the taxonomic classifications of apes, who are often classified as satyrs. This was part of the Latin classifications of them. Satyrs, of course, are classical demigods made up of humans and goats, who are notoriously randy and licentious. And apes, kind of through, it would seem, no fault of their own, are very much part in kind of Western culture, at least, of this representation. But Baudelaire's review suggests that actually female audiences for these works of art might have other reasons for being interested in it. And not just in terms of the date, but also in terms of the nature of this response, there's a very clear parallel with the gorilla specimens that were displayed by Paul Du Chaillu in London in 1861. Du Chaillu brought gorilla cadavers pickled in alcohol and then put them on display. One thing that was immediately noticed was that Du Chaillu or his taxidermist had removed the genitals of the apes. And something similar had happened to the frontispiece of Du Chaillu's book, where the picture of the ape in the wild actually fortuitously holds a bush that covers its groin. So it's as if there is a fig leaf that is covering this. This happens literally in the gorilla bodies that are displayed in the Royal Geographical Society. Du Chaillu's friend, Richard F. Burton, the rather notorious explorer who was very, very interested in a variety of sexual matters, later in the 1880s, recalled the general disappointment in England and America caused by the exhibition of my friend Paul Du Chaillu's gorillas. He had modestly removed penis and testicles, and his squeamishness caused not a little grumbling and sense of grievance, especially amongst the curious sex. By that, of course, he means women. It's a very, very similar response to Baudelaire. I think they're seeing women as far more interested in sex and animals that are often represented as being prime examples of rampant male lasciviousness than Victorian culture would generally allow. Now, I think there's an interesting connection between this and the next artwork that I want to go on to look at, by a Belgian artist called Felicien Rop, and it's part of a series of three, and it's the third one that I'm looking at. These are known either as Transformismes or Darwiniques, and this is the third one that Rop also added the subtitle The Predecessor, and it's another image of an ape, though this one less of a specific simian species. It's much more of a generalized image of an ape. This is admittedly a rather kind of striking and perturbing. But I think that the first thing that's noticeable about this one is that this is not an encounter between a passive female and a bestial abhuman ape. There is no savagery or aggression here. In fact, even the sexual act that is being performed, I think, is one that is clearly not indicative of male sexual aggression, that in many ways the female here is the one who is in charge, the one who has kind of the agency of desire here. In some ways, she has direct eye contact with us as the viewers. There is nothing that is shameful here, nothing that is being hidden, it would seem. There is, as is less clear in the sculpture, it's clearer here is the contrast of tone and colour. The ape or the monkey is clearly kind of hairy and brown, whereas the woman is very explicitly Caucasian and white. And I think one thing that ought to be noted here is that these kind of images, and certainly this one is not unique in 19th century visual culture, encode certain racial taboos about black and white sexuality. These were things of very great concern, most notably in the United States, where miscegenation, as it was known, breeding or sexual relations between races, was an incredibly fraught and problematic issue. So Rops is here very deliberately confronting very many taboos in 19th century culture. I think that if we're shocked by this image, in many ways we're supposed to be. It is, though, perhaps of all the images maybe in this entire exhibition, one of the few that, as we can see by its title, is explicitly a response to Darwin and his theories. It dates, although we can't be exact, from around 1879. It appears certainly that Rops was aware of Darwin's work. He writes in a catalogue of having come across a volume by a very savant clerk of Great Britain called Darwin, and that it made a horrible dream. This, it would appear, is the dream, and the volume that he came across is presumably The Descent of Man, that had appeared by that time in French translation. So we have here a difference from the Frémiet, a much more savage and bestial imagery. Interestingly, the connection with Baudelaire is very clear, because Rop, throughout his career, had been involved in collaborations with Baudelaire and was a regular illustration of Baudelaire's poetic publications. And it would seem that the Rop, rather like Burton, shares Baudelaire's vision of women as animalistic, so one that is very different from that of mainstream 19th century culture, and in particular that presented in Darwin's version of sexual selection in The Descent of Man. In this etching, Rop shows the intimate kinship between human an animal. So in many ways it could be seen as an image that conforms to Darwin's evolutionary thinking. But in showing the female as being active, as being the agent in desire, I think it does really interesting work in unpacking some of those problematic, unresolved issues in Darwin's own presentation of sexual selection. There are a number of scientific critics in the 1870s who dwelt on precisely this issue in The Descent of Man. And I think Rops, although we might think of this as an explicit image, even a pornographic image, I think it's an image that in many ways does engage with some of the problems in Darwin's representation of sexual selection. But I think that both this and Frémiet's sculpture, the frontispiece to Du Chaillu's book, and also the responses that the audience to Du Chaillu's Pickled Gorillas create a visual context of the representation of gorillas as sexualized, whether that is imposing themselves upon passive and resisting females or engaging with females who are kind of more than happy to accept their attentions. That throughout this visual context, apes are represented as extremely sexualized creatures. And I think this links very interestingly with many of the caricatures of Darwin himself that were produced, particularly in the 1870s after The Descent of Man. One of the coincidentally amusing things about Darwin is that actually his physiognomy did look rather like that of an ape. He had a large forehead and a heavy protuberant brow, and caricaturists kind of were very quick to pick up on this and to depict him in numerous images in an ape-like way. Darwin, it's well known, actually kind of found this quite funny and collected many of these images. But I think if we think about these caricatures that are often seen as simply just funny and rather kind of warm images of the great naturalist, if we think about these in relation to this wider visual context of the way that apes are represented in 19th century culture, I think that there's at least a frisson of alternative interpretations of them. And one thing that we might think about is, if we look at the ape in Rops's provocative Transformisme or Darwinique number 3, is that its tail is noticeably erect, and it is, of course, engaged in sexual activity with the female. And we also have an erect tail, but an erect tail of Darwin as an ape in an image called That Troubles Our Monkey Again, which was in the satirical magazine Fun, which emerged actually as a rival to Punch. There was so much fun to be had in the 19th century, particularly from ideas around Darwin and monkeys, that actually there were kind of a whole set of rivals to Punch. Fun was probably the most fun of those rivals. And this shows Darwin, it's indisputably Darwin, as kind of darkly hirsute monkey with a fantastically long and, I would have thought, suggestively erect tail, holding the hand of a fashionably dressed young lady. He's actually taking her pulse. This is Darwin's interest in the expression of the emotions in man and animals on the issue of blushing and the flow of blood to the skin and what this says about our expressions and our emotions. Darwin, in that book, talks about the way that females, when they are confronted by desirous males, often blush, and that this shows a certain response. So that there's a certain kind of sexual dynamic to this image. But of course, it is Darwin as a monkey, and we know that monkeys were sexualized in 19th century visual culture, confronting a woman who seems not altogether enamored of his attentions. She says to him, "Really, Mr. Darwin, say what you like about man, but I wish you would leave my emotions alone." And he seems to be holding her wrist rather against her will. And I think in this image, there is a suggestion of alternate, maybe darker interpretations than simply that this is a fun cartoon, warmly kind of parodying and gently satirizing our great naturalist. I think the coterie of bohemian cartoonists and satirists who wrote for things like Punch and Fun would likely have been aware of some of the gentlemanly and louche material that I've been talking about, and that it may have impinged upon their representations of Darwin. I think that because The Descent of Man was seen as so interested in sexuality and suffused with a concern with sexuality, I think that feeds through even to the most seemingly innocuous cartoons.